So today I want to finish up talking about the generalized formalism, and then we can move on to talking about realist theories in the rest of the week. Got a fair bit to get through, so I may speed through certain things, but today we're going to finish up talking about quantum dynamics, completely positive trace preserving maps. Then we will talk about positive operator valued measures, and finally a little bit on the Lindblad equation, which will be relevant again when we talk about the classical limit at the beginning of next week. Okay, so just to review where we were at last Friday, we showed that you should describe the state of a system in general as a Hilbert space HS, should be described by a density operator, so that's an operator on the Hilbert space, which is positive and has trace one, okay? And then we talked about dynamics, and from the Church of the larger Hilbert space point of view, we showed that the finite time dynamics should be described in this sort of way. So the way that a density operator evolves in time is with this operator some type of decomposition. These MJs are arbitrary operators, and they just have to satisfy this condition, which ensures that the normalization of the state on the global system plus environment is preserved. Okay, so now what I want to do is derive that same thing from the Church of the small Hilbert space type of perspective, and this turns out to be a bit subtle. So remember, according to this smaller Church type of point of view, we want quantum theory to be the only consistent way of assigning probabilities to all observables, right? So we should have that the dynamics should be any mapping of states to states that leads to well-defined probabilities for observables at the output of the map. This turns out to be a bit subtle. First thing I'm going to do is generalize this a little bit from what we were doing last time. Last time I assumed that the input and output Hilbert spaces were the same. I'm in general going to allow here that the output Hilbert space is different from the input Hilbert space. So your dynamics might involve something like adding a new subsystem to the system, or it may involve discarding part of your subsystem out to the environment. So we're not going to assume that it's the same dimension of Hilbert space necessarily. So clearly, since density operators are the only way of assigning probabilities consistently to observables, our map needs to be some sort of mapping from the linear operators on Hilbert space A to the linear operators on Hilbert space B that maps density operators to density operators. Okay, so the first thing we're going to demand is that this should be a linear map. Now let's see why. Suppose that at the input system, we prepare some system in this density operator with probability P, and this one with probability 1 minus p by, say, flipping a coin and based on the outcome of the coin flip, choosing which density operator to prepare. Now, the probabilities are linear functions of the density operator. So what we would expect to happen there is that the linear combination should give us the same probabilities as if we, with probability p, just tracked what happened to density operator A, row A, sorry, and with probability 1 minus P, tracked what happened to sigma A, right? So we could do the two calculations separately, say, okay, I've got this outcome, what would happen here? I've got this outcome, what would happen there? And then if you averaged over your ignorance about which of these two outcomes occurred, you would expect to get this, right? So you expect that your mapping must be linear on positive linear combinations, so probabilistic linear combinations. So strictly speaking, what that means is that this map has to be affine. Affine means that you're linear, but only on necessarily on convex combinations, on combinations with positive coefficients here. However, if your convex space happens to live within a linear space, in this case, the linear space of all operators, then you can always extend an affine map to a linear one just by defining what it does on negative combinations like this, just by definition. In some sense, this is an unphysical thing, but it doesn't matter because any operator that acts like this has an extension that acts like that. So we know that we have a linear operator from linear operators to linear operators, okay? So this object lives in the space of linear operators that map linear operators to linear operators. Okay, so sometimes this is called a super operator, an operator on operators. Okay, so now here comes the fun part. So the input space, remember, the space of linear operators can always be written as the output space tensor, the dual of the input space. So here the input and output space are both HA. And what I'm just gonna do here is give them different indices so that we can keep track of which one's the input and which one's the output. Right, so HA1 and HA2, they're the same Hilbert space, but I'm just keeping track of which one's which one's input and which one's output. Similarly, LHB, linear operators on HB, can be written as this is the output space and this is the input space, the dual for the input space. Okay, so the linear operators from LHA to LHB is the same thing as the linear operators from this tensor product space to this tensor product space. But now we can do the same thing again. So the linear operators from here to here should be this is the output space, tensor the dual of the input space. So if I dualize the input space, I'm gonna put the dagger on A2 here and no dagger there. So I'm just gonna get this thing. So really, it lives in the tensor product of four sort of primitive Hilbert spaces. Okay, so in the ordering here, when we're thinking of it as an object in this space, the order of these things doesn't matter because I'm gonna keep track of that with indices. So I'm just gonna order it A1, A2, B1, B2 like this. And you see that in Dirac notation, it should be an object that looks like this. So we have a vector A1, a dual vector A2, we have a dual vector B1, and a vector B2. So in abstract index notation, you have a vector and a dual vector for each of A and B. And in diagrammatic notation, it's just this kind of thing with two dual indices and two vector indices. Okay, so then the action, so the density operator that it's acting on is an operator on, it's an operator on A. So it's in the tensor product of A with A's dual, right? So the natural way that this acts on a density operator is like this. You contract with the A indices. This is gonna leave you with an operator on B. Okay, so in Dirac notation, it looks like this. We're just gonna plug the row into here between the A1 and A2. And in abstract index notation, it's just contracting out the A indices. Okay, so it has to be that sort of object. But what we need to do is get the operator some type of decomposition that we had from the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space point of view picture. And here's where this is fun, right? So you have this thing living in this tensor product, and we've previously thought of it as this space. But this has a load of other different interpretations. I can order these terms differently and think of it in terms of linear operators in a different way. So what I can do is I can put the one indices together and the two indices together. So I've got an AB pair here and an AB pair there. This space here is, let's see, this is, oh, there's a dagger missing there, isn't there? No. Yeah. So this is the dual space to B1, right? So this can be thought of as the linear operators from B1 to A1. And this one here can be thought of as the linear operators from A2 to B2. But remember, the linear operators from B to A are the dual of the linear operators from A to B. Right, so here I have a tensor product of the linear operators from A to B, the dual of that space, with the linear operators from A to B again. So this is, remember, one and two are just sort of dummy labels to keep track of what's input, what's output. Right, this space here is just the dual of that space. So I can think of this as the linear operators acting on the linear operators from A to B, right? So this is the dual space. This is the input space in that sense, and this is the output space. Okay, so there's a different way of decomposing the same thing, right? So if you think about it in terms of this, this means that we're in the tensor product. So we're going to have operators from A to B tensor producted with operators from B to A. This already sounds a bit like what was happening in the operator sum decomposition, where you had, you wrote it in terms of operators from A to B, basically. So, I mean, all this really is reconceptualizing this operation here. Where is it? So here, I've written the A indices all here and the B indices here, but I can reorder these terms. I can just move this B over to the left here and this B over to the right here. And then you can see that I've got a row in the middle with an operator from B to A on the left and an operator from A to B on the right. Okay. So this thing, these things live in this space, I can think of it, it is just an inner product space. So I can think of that as my space of kets, if I like. Think of it as a space of kets. It's going to define a rounded ket to mean that. And then I can think of the dual space, the operators from B to A, as a space of bras, if I like. It's the dual space to that. Okay? So I'm going to sort of conceptualize this kind of thing as a ket, and this is a bra in that space. So then my map here is just some kind of operator. It's an operator in that space. Okay? It maps these things to these things. So it's just an operator on a vector space. That vector space happens to be this one. Okay? But since that's an inner product space, everything you know about eigenvalues and so forth will be the same on that space. It's just an example of a linear operator. Okay, so now we have to do two things. So the first is if we can show that in the sense of being an operator like this, this is positive, then we'll get an operator sum decomposition. So why is that? So let's suppose it's a positive operator on that space. That means that for all vectors, which are now linear operators from A to B, this combination, so putting the operator here and the dual operator there, this means this. If, and it, here it is in abstract index notation, if it's positive, then we know from what we proved last time that positive operators have are self-adjoint and have positive eigenvalues. So in terms of an operator on that space, it will look something like this, where these are the positive eigenvalues and these are the eigenoperators now. In terms of diagrams, the positivity condition looks like this, right? So the A and I've swapped it so that from what I drew it previously. So previously I drew the A indices together here and the B indices together here. Now I've just swapped it so that I've got an A paired with a B and an A paired with a B. So this is the action of an operator from A to B. This is an action of its dual from B to A. That combination should be positive. Okay, so if I've got this decomposition, then I can define a rescaled operator, MJ, which just rescaled by the square root of the eigenvalue. Okay, if I do that, then in terms of these bras and kets, it'll look like that. But that means that the action on the density operator, because if we go back to here, the action of the density operator has one of the factors of linear operators from A to B on one side and the dual action on the other side, right? So the way an operator that looks like this will act will be precisely the operator sum type of decomposition. We have one operator acting on the left-hand side and the dual acting on the right-hand side. Okay, so that's the main thing we've got to prove. But before we go there, I'm just going to quickly show that if you have this decomposition, you should also have this condition that we had in the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space picture. So what we need is that we map density operators to density operators. So the output of this should have trace one, if the input has. In particular, the output of this map should have the same trace as the input of the map. That's what we mean by trace preserving. So if it happens that you satisfy this condition, then if you have this operator sum decomposition, you can use the cyclic property of the trace to move this guy around to this side here. Then we have this operator sum over J of these guys. If that's the identity, then you'll be trace preserving. Conversely, if the map is trace preserving, then let's see what happens when we take a pure vector input state. Then we can again use the cyclic property of the trace to show that if you're trace preserving, this has to be one. And then we move it around and we see that this operator sandwiched between any state has to be one. Okay, so we have an equation like this where n is this operator, which is the sum of these guys. Okay, so then what you can show is that if this is equal to one for all unit vectors, then this operator must be one, which is the converse. So the proof is fairly simple. You just, first of all, let psi be one of the basis vectors. Then the positivity condition tells you that the diagonal entries are equal to one, which you expect to the identity matrix. And then you do two other things. Let psi equal an equal superposition of two basis vectors, and also an equal superposition with a phase factor of I. Then you plug these things into the positivity condition, and that gives you two equations, this one and this one, once we take into account the fact that we've already shown that these two things are one. Right, so they're going to cancel with the one on that side. Okay, so then you take this equation, these two equations, and you sum them, and that tells you that the off-diagonal entries are zero, so you have the identity operator. Okay, so we've shown that you have to have this condition that this operator is equal to the identity. Okay, so now the more subtle bit. So it would be nice, from the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space point of view, if you could show that this positivity condition that we need just follows from the requirement that the output of this map should be a positive operator. We've already used the trace one property. The only other property we've got left is that it should be positive. Superoperator that does that is called a positive superoperator, but that's not what actually happens. What happens instead is a little bit of an embarrassment for the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space point of view. Because what you can show is that if your system happens to be correlated with its environment, and oh dear, in the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space, we don't like to introduce considerations of larger Hilbert spaces, but there you go. When you act with your map on system A alone, you also need to make sure that the state of the system and the environment is still a density operator. Otherwise, you would get negative probabilities if you did a joint measurement on the two later. So we need that this should be true as well when you act this on system A, a subsystem of a system correlated with its environment. And a superoperator that has that property is called completely positive. And it turns out that there are positive operators that are not completely positive. If there's time, I can tell you how I think you can fix the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space point of view in light of this, but that's a bit of a side topic, so I won't go into that now. So here's an example of an operator that's positive but not completely positive. It's the transpose map. So if you take a map that just swaps the two indices around, here the input and output systems have the same dimension, so I can do that. So abstract index notation, it's just swapping the two indices. Doing so, you have a square matrix and you take its transpose, that doesn't change the eigenvalues at all. So it's going to preserve the eigenvalues and hence it will be a positive map. It'll map density operators to density operators. And furthermore, it's clearly linear as well. Okay, so that's a positive map. However, if you consider your input, output, and the environmental system to be qubits, then we take this maximally entangled state. Then if I sort of write out this projector, this input state projector, then it looks like this. I'm just going to get, you know, each of these terms is going to go with each of these terms in the Bra version. I'm going to get these four terms. Then when I act the transpose map, it does nothing to this term, and it does nothing to this term. But on this term, for subsystem A, the 0 and 1 are going to get swapped. And here, for subsystem A, the 0 and 1 are going to get swapped as well. So I will get terms that map 0, 1 to 1, 0, and a term that maps 1, 0 to 0, 1. Okay. Now it's easy to see that this thing, the a linear combination of 0, 1, minus 1, 0, is an eigenvector of this purported density operator, which has eigenvalue minus a half. So it's not a positive operator, right? Why is that? Because this operator here swaps 0, 1 to 1, 0, and 1, 0 to 0, 1. Right? So these two terms are going to get swapped. I'll get a minus 1 outside. There's an overall factor of a half here. So the eigenvalue is minus a half. It's not positive. Okay. So complete positivity is something different. So for complete positivity, we require that if I act this map on a system correlated with its environment, should be a positive operator for any correlated, possibly correlated input state on the system plus the environment. What does that mean? That means that if I take this input state, act with the map on system A, and then sandwich it between any vector on the environment and the output system, right? That's the space that my output density operator lives on. That has to be positive for any vector in the tensor product of, sorry, that should be BE here. Okay, right. So let's look at a special case. Let's take as our input vector this one. Okay, so this is the unnormalized, this is the what I called the delta function state before. It's it correlates two subsystems. Here A and A prime are the same Hilbert space, just different labels. And it's an unnormalized version of the maximally entangled state, right? So the normalization here doesn't matter. That's not going to affect the positivity. It's just going to be an overall constant factor. So in particular, if I input this, this which is proportional to the projector onto the maximally entangled state, into my map, that should give me positive for all vectors here. But this turns out to be equivalent to this condition, which is the condition that I needed for the operator sum decomposition. So this is positivity, where I think of this this object here as a map from this space to itself. Okay, so now this psi is a linear operator from HA to HB. Okay, so if we can prove that, then we're more or less done. So here it is. The diagrammatic proof is kind of nice, right? So here, this thing, remember, this delta vector is just this curved line. This delta dual vector is this curved line. And what we're really doing is we're contracting. So this is this whole object here. And remember, in diagrams, you can stretch, like, as long as you write down something that's topologically the same, topologically equivalent, you can pull lines and things like that as much as you like. So what I can do is I can do this contraction here by bringing this thing around up here. So this contraction turns this upper line into a lower line out of psi, and vice versa. And this is exactly the diagram that was positivity for operators. So what I'm doing here is I'm converting a vector on the tensor product of A and B into an operator from A to B. If you prefer the abstract index notation, it looks like this, right? So here I have a vector delta, sorry, this is the dual vector delta down here with lower indices. This is the vector delta. And then I've got the indices of my completely positive map. And this guy contracts with the index from the environment and one of the indices from the completely positive map. Okay, so this is acting, yeah, so that's right. So that's how that works, right? So this is an abstract index notation, and you can see that I can just combine these two things to contract, sorry, this one with this one, I can contract the n index, and that will lower that index, like this. And I can contract this one with this guy over here. Sorry, that's the one I just did. I can contract this one with this guy over here, and that will lower this, that will raise the A index up here, right? So I'll have this kind of combination. I've converted these vectors into operators by doing that. And that's just the positivity condition that I needed for this object. Is there any questions about that? Yes.
At the very start of this, you talked about affine maps.
Yeah.
But it looked like the condition you had was convex linearity.
Convex linearity is affine, same thing. I mean, if you okay, so. Okay, so in more abstract terms, you have the space of normalized states, and then you can embed that in the cone of unnormalized states. Okay, convex linear map on the state space, on the normalized state space, is an affine map on the cone of unnormalized states, which can then be extended to a linear map on the space of all operators. That's the claim. All right. So that's enough to prove. We proved this trace preservation condition earlier, and I showed you that if you have this positivity condition here, then you're going to get an operator sum decomposition, right? Now, because I used a special input state, I used the delta function input state, we still need in principle to check that this thing is going to be positive. There aren't any further constraints that if I am put in any density operator, this will still be positive. But we can do this because rho AE is itself a positive operator. I can define its square root, right? So that's the thing that has the same eigenvectors and just the square roots of the eigenvalues. And when I multiply it by itself, it'll give me rho AE. And then this combination, which is one of these terms, is just an operator multiplied by its dagger. So it's of the form n dagger n, which we previously showed was necessary and sufficient for this whole operator to be positive. So then we have a sum of operators that are positive. It's very easy to see that if you have the sum of two operators that are positive, that will itself be positive, because I'm just going to get psi n psi plus psi m psi, and if both of these terms are positive, then so is that, right? So we know it works for all positive operators on the system and the environment, so we're done, basically. We know that's a positive operator. So the summary is this. So a physical map from density operators to density operators must be of this form, sum of operators like this, satisfying this condition. We could derive this from two points of view. So the system, the larger Hilbert space point of view, the system acts unitarily with an environment that it's initially uncorrelated with. That's what we did last time. And we can also derive it from the point of view that the map must be completely positive, maps density operators to density operators, even if they're potentially correlated to an outside system. And it should be trace preserving. Okay, so that's basically the two ways of deriving that. Just to give you some examples of what these things look like, let's have a look at a couple of qubit examples. So if you have a qubit, then one possible map is a map that just gives you the maximally mixed state, so the point at the center of the Bloch sphere with some probability, or leaves you in the original state with a certain probability. Now, if this is a CPT map, it needs to be written in terms of this Kuiper-Krauss form. But you can do that. I've not done the calculation here, but you can show that if you take the Krauss operators proportional to the identity and the three Pauli operators with these different weightings, then you can prove that's the same thing, and it satisfies this condition. And what that map does for you is it basically shrinks the Bloch sphere, so everything gets closer to the maximally mixed state. So if you start with a Bloch sphere like that, then the whole space gets scaled by a factor p, and you end up with a smaller Bloch sphere, everything's more mixed, closer to the identity. And here's another example which is very relevant for the theory of decoherence. Here we have two Krauss operators. If we take two Krauss operators that look like this, with a parameter lambda, then you can show that what happens to the Bloch sphere is it gets compressed into an ellipsoid, right? So it gets compressed around the sigma 1, sigma 2 axis. So you end up with states that are, in some sense, more diagonal in the 0, 1 basis like this. Okay, this is sort of the typical effect of a sort of decoherence type of map where, over time, the off-diagonal elements get smaller and the state becomes more diagonal in a certain basis. Okay, so that's just so I haven't worked out all the details, but if you put in these operators, you can convince yourself that that's what happens. Okay, so now I just briefly want to talk about measurements again. So remember, from the Church of the Larger Hilbert space point of view, we have temporarily, until about lecture 11 or so, allowed ourselves to have projective measurements as a primitive operation. Okay, but we don't need to necessarily make a measurement directly on the system. What we could do is correlate a system to its environment and then measure the environment and then view that as telling us something about the system. So how does that look if I want to think of it as a measurement on the system? So in diagrams, it's something like this. I start off with my initial state. It's in a density operator correlated with some reference system. I'm going to interact it with some other system that it's initially uncorrelated with. Okay, so with a unitary. So we know that that's going to enact some completely positive map in general on the system now. But now we're going to make a projective measurement on the environment and view that as somehow telling us information about the system. So the question is, can we describe the probabilities for the measurement outcomes in terms of operators on the system alone? Right? I don't want to go around tracking the environment degrees of freedom. I want to know, can I do this calculation just in terms of the system on its own? Okay, so this is very similar to what we did with the case of dynamics. What we're going to do is we're going to start with our system in a certain density operator. It's going to be tensor producted with the environment system. We're going to do the unitary, and then finally we're going to do the projective measurement, and we have to trace over the system and the environment. And that's the usual probability rule for objective measurement. Now what we can do is we can use the cyclic property of the trace and also the fact that these two are on different systems, so they commute past each other, right? So I can commute this to the left of here and then cycle around the terms until the psi e is right on the left here, the phi e is right on the left here, okay? So then I'm going to do the trace over the environment part. I'm only going to trace out the environment system. So I'm going to take a sum over the environment kets and put it on the left here and on the right. This part doesn't depend on the environment, so that's just going to go straight through. And then what I can do is, because this term here is just a number now, this is just an inner product, it's a scalar, I can move it over here. And when I do that, I will have these k's going together, and I'll have an identity operator here. Okay, so what I'm going to be left with is this thing, which is an operator on system S, because it's contracted out the environment here. acting on the density operator on system S. So if I define this thing EJ to be this operator here, then I can write this as a trace just on the system of this operator, which comes from the unit tree, the projector, and the initial state of the environment, times the density operator. So I can do the whole calculation just on the system alone. Okay, so now what properties does this have? Well, the first thing is we can show that it's a positive operator. How do we show that? Well, we have to show that if I put any state vector on the left and right-hand side of this operator, I'll get something positive. But if I expand that out using the definition of the operator here, that's just going to give me this. And this is just a special, so here I've got a product state on the left and a product state on the right. That's just a special case of having a general state on the tensor product on the left and the right. Okay? So this here, if this is positive, that's the condition for positivity of this whole operator inside here. But this operator is again of the form n dagger n, because the projector, this is a projector, it squares to itself. If I set n to be this thing, and then multiply n dagger n, I'll get the thing in the middle here. So that's positive, and hence, as a consequence, this operator on the system alone is positive. And the second condition is that when I sum over all of the possible outcomes here, I should get the identity on the system. And again, we derive that from, can derive that from unitarity. So if I take the sum of these operators, then I'm going to get a sum over j, but I can bring that all the way into the middle where the projectors are, because that's the only thing that depends on j. And then this is a projective measurement. So these guys sum to the identity. Then I've just got a u dagger u here, so that's the identity. And then I've just got to take the inner product of these environment systems. So they're going to come through, and I'll just be left with the identity on the system. Okay. And then as in the case we did in the CP map, so I'm not going to go through this in detail, but you can show that any set of operators that satisfy these two conditions, this one and this one, can arise in this way as a coupling of the system to the environment followed by measuring the environment. That's what we mean by a positive operator valued measure. The smaller church point of view here is very easy, by the way. This is a nice one. So we derive the same thing. So according to the smaller church, any consistent way of assigning probabilities to measurement outcomes should describe some sort of valid measurement. Okay. So that means that a measurement outcome should be described by, again, one of these affine functionals. So it should map density operators to real numbers. But again, we want the outcome J should be convex linear in this sense, because if I flip a coin and either prepare one density operator or the other density operator, I expect that the probability that I get for this outcome should just be the mixture of the two probabilities I get for the individual states. So again, you can extend this to a linear. So remember, the density operators are self-adjoint. So I can extend this now to a linear functional on, now I'm going to just do it on the self-adjoint operators rather than all the linear operators by doing this. Okay. So now I have a linear functional on the set of self-adjoint operators. That means it is a dual, it's in the dual space to the set of self-adjoint operators. And we showed last time that the set of self-adjoint operators is its own dual. Okay, and here's the inner product. You don't need a dagger here this time because these operators are self-adjoint. So we know that if it's going to satisfy this condition, it must be of this form for some self-adjoint operator, because the self-adjoint operators is its own dual space. So all we need to do is prove it's positive. It has to be positive. But that's very easy to see, because we want, if these are going to be the probabilities, they have to be greater than or equal to zero. So in particular, let's take a pure input state. Then the trace of EJ with that would be this. So this thing being greater than or equal to naught is implies that this should be greater than or equal to naught, and that's just the positivity condition. This will, if it holds for pure state vectors, then it will hold for all density operators, because I can always write it in its eigendecomposition as some probabilities and the eigenvectors. And then if each of these individual terms is going to give me something positive, then the convex combination will also. So that's sufficient for this to be positive for all density operators. Okay, so then the other condition that we had before was that the sum over J of the operators should be the identity. But the sum over J of these things is just the sum of the probabilities for the different outcomes. So if you're going to have a well-defined probability distribution for the outcomes, this has to equal 1. Okay, so then I can take the sum on the inside, and if I use psi psi as an example, I will, as when I was deriving the equivalent condition for the operator sum decomposition, I will see that this has to be 1 for all pure states. But we already proved when we were doing the same thing with the sum of the MJ dagger MJs, that if you have this equal to 1 for all pure states, then this thing has to be the identity. So we just use the same proof here, and we get the second condition. Right, so the summary of that is a general measurement has to be described by a set of positive operators that sum to the identity. This is what is called a positive operator valued measure. The probability rule is going to be the trace of that operator against the density operator. And we can derive this from two points of view. A system either interacts with an environment it's initially uncorrelated with, and you perform a projective measurement on the environment, or just the requirement that measurements should be things that assign well-defined probability distributions to all density operators. Okay, those two points of view give you the same thing. I'm not going to go through this in detail because we're a bit short on time, but I just want to say that you shouldn't always think of a PAVM as, you shouldn't think of the projective measurements as somehow the perfect better measurements and the POVMs as somehow just noisy versions of them. There are certain tasks, a lot of information tasks actually, for which a POVM is the optimal thing to do. I'm not going to go through this in detail because I want to get through the Lindblad thing. I finally in this section want to talk about the Lindblad equation. This will be very relevant when we discuss the classical limits next week. So when you have unitary dynamics, so a system in the larger Hilbert space point of view, you have an isolated system that's not interacting with its environment, then the density operator dynamics is like this. And if this unitary is generated by a fixed Hamiltonian, we just have Schrodinger evolution, then it will look like this. And then what we can do is work out what this looks like to first order and get an equation of motion for the density operator. Okay. So what happens, because you have H acting on the left and H acting on the right with an opposite sign, is that when you work this through, you'll get something which looks like a commutator, which is a commutator between H and rho. So the equation of motion for unitary dynamics is just this, and this looks the same. You should be familiar with this type of equation. It looks like the Heisenberg equation of motion. Take care, though, because we're still in the Schrodinger picture here, right? It's the states that are revolving, not the measurement operators. But when you apply Schrodinger evolution to the density operator, you get an equation that looks exactly like the Heisenberg equation, and it tends to be called the von Neumann equation in this context. So when we have unitary dynamics, we can have a continuous time evolution for the system. But we know that unitary dynamics isn't the end of the story now. So now we know that if you have a finite time discrete dynamics, it gets described by a completely positive trace preserving map. And the question is there a continuous time dynamics which basically is the continuous version of this. So you might have thought, so there's some subtleties here, you might have thought that you can just, you know, so take this finite time dynamics and break it up into a number of small time steps, right? So parameterize these maps by t, and then we would want to say that if I evolve for an extra time step delta t, then I should be able to just evolve for t and compose it for the extra time step. So in other words, what I mean is that if I want to work out rho at t0 plus t plus delta t, I first evolve it using the map to time t, and then I evolve it for the extra delta t. So if this were true, what it would do is give the dynamics, these maps, the structure of a what's called a continuous semigroup. It's only a semigroup because the dynamics is not unitary. There might be losses to the environment. So these maps don't necessarily have inverses. Can't necessarily go back to where I started, right? So that means that you get a semigroup rather than a group, but you still expect that as t goes to zero, that this thing becomes the identity superoperator, right? So in that sense, you still have a unit, an identity for the semigroup. However, there's a problem with this idea from the point of view of the Church of the larger Hilbert space. So if you remember that in order to derive CPT maps in that case, we had to assume that the system was initially uncorrelated from its environment. Okay, we started off with an environment system that was uncorrelated and then did a unitary evolution. So if you want this kind of thing to hold, then if you want this to be CPT and then CPT again for the next delta t, then you want the system to be uncorrelated with its environment after every delta t time step. But you don't expect that to happen in general, right? What will happen is you start with your system, even if you start off with it uncorrelated with the environment, you do your unitary for a step delta t, your Hamiltonian interaction with system and environment, then you generally expect to be left with some state that's correlated here. So we won't be able to derive that when you apply the unitary again for another time step, you won't be able to derive that that's a completely positive trace preserving map, because we needed this kind of setup where you were uncorrelated from the environment. Okay, so we're not going to be able to do this kind of trick in general. So what we're going to be able to say is going to be something much more restricted than that. So in order to get something out of sort of a continuous version of CPT completely positive dynamics, you have to assume that the interaction with the environment looks approximately something like this, right? You have to assume that you effectively throw away the environmental system after the first delta t and bring in a new one, right? That's now uncorrelated again. So I'm continually throwing away the environment that I had and bringing in a new one that's uncorrelated. Right, so this will work provided the system behaves as if it's interacting with a new uncorrelated environment system at every step. And you can derive this as an approximation in what's called the weak coupling limit. Now, I don't have time to go into full details about how this works. It's quite subtle. But here's an example of the type of thing where it works. So suppose your environment is actually a heat bath, a very large system in a thermal state, right? A system with a very large number of particles in it in a thermal state. That's what you're interacting with. Now that's going to have some time. So if I perturb the environment, it's going to have some time scale on which it rethermalizes, on which it relaxes back into being a thermal state, okay? And then there's also going to be a time scale of the interaction here, right? How quickly does your system get correlated with your environment? Now, provided your thermal bath rethermalizes much faster than you develop correlations with the environment, then this kind of approximation is going to work well. That's what kind of thing that we mean by the weak coupling limit. Again, you can derive the equation I'm about to show you under slightly weaker assumptions than that, but this is the typical kind of case that you're talking about. Right, so because the environment rethermalizes very quickly at each step, you can more or less assume that it's uncorrelated from your system again. Okay, so now we can, under this condition, under the condition that each delta T is a completely positive trace preserving map, we can derive an equation. So what we're going to do is say, okay, this map, which acts for a small time delta T, has to be of the completely positive trace preserving form. It has to have this operator sum decomposition. Okay, so if this is acting for time delta T, we expect to get something that's close to our initial state plus some terms that are of order delta T. So what we want to do is expand this evolution to first order in delta T and then take the limit and get a differential equation. Now, the derivation I'm going to give you here is like going to be fairly heuristic due to lack of time. You can look at very specific models of how the system interacts with an environment and get it in a different way. But just to give you a rough outline. Now, each of the terms in this decomposition has to be of order 1 or order delta t. Anything that's smaller than that, we don't care about. And you can, without loss of generality, put all of the order 1 term in a single one of the Krauss operators. The reason you can do this is there is an ambiguity in the Krauss operator decomposition. There's more than one Krauss operator decomposition of the same map. There's actually a unitary degree of freedom in mixing them. And by exploiting that, you can put all of the term that's proportional to the identity into one of them. Again, I don't have time to explain that in full detail. This is just to give you a sort of heuristic idea of where this equation comes from. So one of my Krauss operators, I'm going to assume, has a term proportional to the identity, which is going to be responsible for the part where the density operator stays the same. And then it could also have a term of order delta t. And here, I'm just expanding that term. You know, so if you have a general operator, you can always write it in terms of a Hermitian part and an anti-Hermitian part, just like you can write a complex number in terms of its real and imaginary part. Right, so this operator, I can expand into two Hermitian operators, one of which gets an I. Right, that's general. You can generally write an operator like that. This one I'm calling H because, as you may suspect, it's going to turn out to be the Hamiltonian. Okay, so then the other terms are not going to have an order 1. They're not going to have an identity part. So in order for them to contribute at order delta t, they have to first order be square root delta t. We've got an m and an m dagger here. So again, this is a bit heuristic, but if we assume that these things can be expanded to order square root delta t plus a higher order terms, then the first order term that you'll get from these will be delta t. Okay, so then we just plug that in, right? So and we only expand to order delta t. So I'm going to take the rho of t to the other side. That's going to be what comes from the identity. But then when I do m0 dagger, the first order in delta t, I'm going to get this acting on the left and a term where it acts on the right. And then I'll get these terms, the terms that come from here. So all in all, you get this. And this is the first order term. And I can rewrite this like this. So this, the H parts here are going to give me a commutator because they come with different signs. And the L part is going to give me an anti-commutator. And then I get this term, which looks like the regular CPT map type of thing. So then I'm going to divide by delta T and take the limit. And that says that you should have an equation like this. This is what's called the Lindblad equation. Okay. So note that this term here is the same as the von Neumann equation. It's just going to give you unitary evolution. Plus, you're going to have these correction terms. It should be noted, however, that this Hamiltonian, like if you interact a system with its environment, And the Hamiltonian consists of a system Hamiltonian plus an interaction Hamiltonian, then this term here isn't just the system Hamiltonian. It generally gets some correction from the interaction with the environment. And it's pretty complicated to derive what it is, but there is a Hamiltonian part, is the point. Okay, so then we still have to impose the trace preserving condition, which is this. Okay, that's gonna give us some extra constraints on the operators. So if I look at the M0 operator, I assume these two operators were Hermitian. And so that's gonna be this. There's just gonna be a minus sign here from the I. So when I multiply those out, the H terms cancel, and I just get that this is I plus something that's 2L0 at order delta T. And when I do the other terms at order delta T, I'm just gonna get the usual LJ dagger LJ. Now, this plus this, oops. Where were we? Yeah, so it's this plus this, which has to equal the identity. This already has an identity term in, so this part at order delta T and this part added together have to cancel. Okay, so L0 here is gonna be, 2L0 here is gonna be minus this, so L0 has to be written in terms of the other operators like this. That's going to give you the final form of the Lindblad equation, which is you have this unitary part, and then you have a part which involves some arbitrary number of operators. And this is basically the non-unitary dynamics part. And this part here is needed to make sure that your density operator remains normalized in the dynamics. This keeps it, when I add this term, I need to subtract this term in order to keep the trace preservation requirement. So that's all pretty abstract. Let me give you an example of how this works, a very simple example. If we just consider a qubit and the Hamiltonian zero, and we just have a single one of these operators, instead of many, we just have one, which I'm gonna take proportional to the power of the operator sigma three. So it's just the 1 and minus 1 on the diagonal. Then, if you plug that into this equation, oops, you plug that into this equation here, then you get just this simple equation like this, right? So, if you work out what that looks like in terms of the components of the density operators, this conjugation by sigma 3, it doesn't change the diagonal of the diagonal ones. And the off-diagonal ones get a minus sign, right? So the diagonal elements are gonna stay the same, and the off-diagonal elements are going to, their derivative is gonna be proportional to themselves with a negative sign. So in general, you have now, this is very easy, you have two uncoupled differential equations, which are actually the same. And that's just going to give you an exponential decay. So what your density operator looks like as a function of time is just that the off-diagonal elements decay exponentially. So again, this is a typical decoherence type of map when you're interacting with the environment. If you get this sort of phase randomization effect, then the off-diagonal elements will decay away very quickly, and you'll be left with something that's diagonal in the 0-1 basis. All right, so I think that's about it, yeah. So that's it for today, unless anyone has any questions. Okay.